I believe that all mothers are just doing the best that they can, regardless of circumstance. But we have to be aware of the ways that commercial interests are actually profiting from dividing us, right? Profiting from us not coming together to push for paid leave, which could benefit all of us, and all the things that we're missing out when we're fighting over something about how we fed our babies.
You're listening to the Untaming Podcast.
Rewild the Child.
Here is your host, Emily.
Hi, I'm Emily, and this is the Untaming Podcast. I have my daughter sitting with me while I record. Would you like to say hello?
Hello.
She just turned, it's just her birthday this week. How old did you turn?
Three.
Three. Today it is the full waking moon here in the southern hemisphere, and this is episode 46. I hope you enjoyed Mary's episode with Helen Ball, the director of the Durham Infancy and Sleep Centre. Today's episode is another one from Mary. This is with Kimberly Seals Allures. She is the author of The Big Letdown, as well as four other books. She's the tech founder of the Earth app and the host of the Birthright podcast. The next episode to come out on the 5th of November to coincide with the new flower moon is with Dr. Ainsley Rogan, a chiropractor. We talk about pelvic floor health before, during, and after pregnancy, optimal pooping positions, car seats, and other baby containers, and a whole lot more. And if you haven't listened to it yet, we had a special appearance from my own father in the last 10 questions in 10 minutes episode. Would you like to say anything more?
I rub my water bottle because Granny and Poppy did it.
You like your water bottle because Granny and Poppy gave it to you?
Yeah.
So anyway, that's enough from us. Here is Mary and Kimberly. Would you like to say goodbye?
Goodbye.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Untaming Podcast. I'm your occasional guest host, Mary Francell, IBCLC. I have a private practice in Bellingham, Washington. I'm also the author of the blog, What Babies Need, at www.whatdobabiesneed.com. And I am just thrilled today to welcome my guest, Kimberly Seals Allures, who is an award-winning journalist and maternal and infant health strategist. She's the author of The Big Letdown, How Medicine, Big Business, and Feminism Undermine Breastfeeding. Kimberly is the founder of Earth, as in birth, but without the B for bias, a new app to address a root cause of the Black maternal and infant mortality crises, racism and bias in care, available now in the Google Play and Apple App Stores. Kimberly is also the host of Birthright, a podcast about joy and healing in Black birth. Learn more at irthapp.com. That's earthapp.com. Her social media handles are imkseals allures and at the Earth app. Last night, she had 6 hours of sleep, and for lunch today, she had a goddess cob salad from Panera Bread. Welcome to the Untaming Podcast, Kimberly. I'm just thrilled to talk to you. I loved your book. I feel like it's one of the most important books that anyone working in breastfeeding should read. It's got some fabulous information in there, and I'm really thrilled about all your new projects. I have been enjoying listening to your podcast. So, welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm so glad. So I'm going to start out by asking you to tell me a little bit about how you became interested in issues surrounding breastfeeding and Black maternal health.
Yeah, such an interesting story. I mean, as you mentioned, Mary, I am a journalist by trade. And so I was having a wonderful career in journalism, working as a writer at Fortune magazine, a senior editor at Essence, and, you know, was really doing my thing, and then became a mother and everything shifted for me. Like many women, just really was just had my eyes open about the experience in general, and then in particularly as a Black woman, and really became passionate about why this system seemed to be broken on so many levels for all of us. And so my very first book, which came out back in 2006, was really a first of its kind pregnancy guidebook that for Black and Brown women that really looked at pregnancy and birth more from a sociocultural perspective, right? I'm not a doctor, but it was more like what's going on in their lived experience that may be contributing to these poorer birth outcomes or the lower breastfeeding rates, right? And I think when, as I got into this work, this idea that the answers were in research models or in medical journals versus my approach as a journalist was, let's just ask the people, right? And so for me, my work has always been rooted in going into communities, asking questions, and actually viewing the community and the people who were being burdened by the issue as the source of solutions. And so that's really how I came into this work, you know, really having a journalist mindset and a line of inquiry, like just keep asking questions until we get to something that actually makes sense. And that's really kind of the spirit I bring to this. It's been an incredible, you know, going on 9 years that I've been kind of in this other world. And it's been, you know, a really amazing journey.
That's fabulous. I'm just so thrilled that you have taken that journey. I want to just talk a little bit to start with about how, you know, obviously humans are mammals, so breastfeeding is the biological norm for our species. But in your book, The Big Letdown, you explore some of the reasons why breastfeeding, chest feeding is difficult for so many people. The subtitle of your book is How Medicine, Big Business, and Feminism Undermine Breastfeeding. So could you start by discussing a little bit about how modern medicine has affected the ability of parents to nurse their babies?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, when I talk about the ways that these elements have influenced breastfeeding, it's really important that we understand that because, as you know, what I found was that when people don't have the breastfeeding or chest feeding journey that they want, they blame themselves, right? They think something's wrong with me, and then they quit. They carry a lot of guilt. Some people, it really, you know, it contributes to their depression. But they aren't even aware that there's a whole system that's been operating long before you or I arrived that is really built for women to fail at breastfeeding. And so that's really what The Big Letdown really seeks to expose and for people to consider is that actually there's a whole system that has been going on ever since they figured out how they can make money by replicating mother's milk that has been set up so that breastfeeding is not successful. Because when breastfeeding is successful, yes, that's better for public health and maternal and infant health, but not always so great for commercial interest and profit motive. And we live in a capitalist society and we enjoy the benefits of that, but we also have to understand how that impacts other things. And so when I looked at the history of pediatrics in particular, which actually began as a specialty focused on replicating mother's milk, look at that history of physicians being used by the formula makers as the marketers for their products, the ways that the physicians wanted to really be the sole expert. At one point, there was no instructions on the formula. It simply said, go see your doctor, right? And so this idea of removing power from mothers, at many points, we look at some historical records, you know, viewing mothers, you know, too silly to manage something as infant feeding, and that it needed to be in the hands of really a white male dominated medical field that sought to demean women's role and sought, you know, failed to fully understand lactation, but instead aligned themselves with commercial interests that also benefited them. And I think that has only gotten worse. And many people don't understand that at all. And so I wanted to let people know about the backdoor deals where hospitals take multi-million dollar deals from infant formula companies just for the right to market to you when you give birth there. And you think that formula is being given to you because it's better or there's some health thing that the hospital figured out. No, that company just paid the highest price to have access to you. And so when we start understanding these elements, then for many people, when they read the Big Letdown, they're like, okay, now I know, right? And that's what I wanted, so that women don't have to carry that on them. It's not you. The system is failing all of us. And the more that we learn about that system and all its elements and players and actors, the more that we can prepare ourselves to go beyond a very simplistic approach, like, oh, well, breast is best and it'll be natural. It's like, no, there's a system to not educate you. There's a system to the hospital don't provide support. There's a system, all the things. So you have to use this information to know better how to go into the process so that we can actually succeed in our goals.
I think it's fascinating about the whole origins of, you know, the white male doctors. I remember finding a prescription, well, it was just kind of a piece of paper written with, you know, how you mix corn syrup and you mix cow's milk and that sort of thing. And it was for my brother's formula. And, you know, before there was like actual commercial formula. And it's just, that's, you know, that's what they thought they knew better than nature. And could you talk a little bit about the mommy wars and how they kind of feed into that, and they make it so like you can't say anything about people who use formula because you're making them feel guilty. And so that kind of helps them, you know, not have to pay attention to all the things they're doing to undermine breastfeeding. Could you talk a little bit about that perhaps?
And I think that's so important because I really feel like the so-called mommy wars are a function of the commercial interests, right? Because it's really, the mommy wars are about selling you something based on whatever camp you choose, right? So it's soccer moms, whether it's soccer moms versus dance moms or breastfeeding versus formula feeding or whatever the thing that they try to divide us. It's a way to sell you something, to sell you an ideology, to sell you an idea, but ultimately to sell you products. So that you can live out that identity. And, you know, I believe that all mothers are just doing the best that they can, you know, regardless of circumstance. But we have to be aware of the ways that commercial interests are actually profiting from dividing us, right? Profiting from us not coming together to push for paid leave, which could benefit all of us, and all the things that we're missing out when we're fighting over something about how we fed our babies, or you know, what sports we're into. I mean, it's just sad. And it's really something that we need to educate ourselves a bit more on so that we could kind of rise above it and not, you know, not be able to kind of be susceptible to it. So that's really, you know, an important part of breastfeeding. When it comes to guilt and shame, there are a couple of things I like to point out. First of all, guilt is an emotion, right? And you're feeling something. It usually means you wanted something that you could not have, right? And so we really need to get to the root of why people are feeling guilty versus, you know, having breastfeeding be accessible for all, right? And I think there's been, and I talk about this in the book, even the ways the breastfeeding movement itself hasn't had the right language or messaging to really, you know, to really encompass what their intention was, right? And so how do we now think about, how do we talk about breastfeeding in a way that understands that, sure, I may want to do it, but in a country where 25% of women are going back to work after 10 days, is it really possible, right? Is it really a choice for me if I have to go back to work in 10 days, if I have an employer who's ignoring federal laws and doesn't have a place for me to pump, you know, if I don't have locally accessible support, if the only group is, you know, maybe something that has nobody who looks like me, you know, like, is it really a choice? And so when we use this type of simplistic language, we negate and we ignore that choices are within choices, number one, and that people need to, many people want to breastfeed, but they can't see how to do it in their lived experience. And so I often talk about separating the act of breastfeeding from the experience of breastfeeding. Like the act of breastfeeding, absolutely. A lactation consultant can help you with your latch, can help you. Someone will help you get that tongue tie issue resolved, all the things. But the experience of breastfeeding, when you live in a country with no federal paid leave, when you live in a country where breasts have been hypersexualized and people are afraid to use their breasts for their biological purpose, when you live in a country where many people are first generation breastfeeders and don't even have support. When you live in a country where, you know, hyperlocal access to breastfeeding groups is limited, like all these things are the reasons why people are struggling with their goals and their journey. But the act is something different. And once we understand that the experience of breastfeeding is deeply traumatizing and stressful for people, then we can better know how we support them in the act. Right. And so that's really what I prefer to talk about and what I want people to get from the big letdown.
Yeah. I mean, it really is in many ways a privileged act, because so many people, you think about, oh, working mothers going back to work and they have an office to pump in and that sort of thing. Well, that's only for like higher income mothers. You know, if you are working at a fast food restaurant or something like that, do you really have the flexibility to pump? You know, is your employer going to be helpful to you?
We even look at teachers. Teachers have the toughest time with mm-hmm. breastfeeding, you know, with their hours. And so, you know, again, saying something is a choice, but not understanding how people can live out that choice with the other choices that they have to make, like working, is really short-sighted and I think harmful. And so I think that now we're at a much more advanced conversation about the nuances and complexities of actually breastfeeding and not just wanting to. And so I think that's really important, but you're right. It's like, you know, sure, if you have an office, but if you work in manufacturing, if you're an hourly worker, if you work in retail, work in fast food, even if you're a school teacher, I mean, nurses too. I mean, they have it tough with their shifts. And so lots of places, a lot of female dominated fields, teachers, nurses are also still struggling around breastfeeding support, even though, you know, great income earners. And so we still have lots of gaps across the socioeconomic spectrum. But to your point, it is being, you know, hard hit by those who may be hourly workers and maybe on the lower end of the earning spectrum.
Right. And I think there often we worry about, you know, making parents feel guilty about not breastfeeding. And yet that guilt feeling is really, I think, in some ways, it's more of a frustration. It should be turned around as a frustration or an anger against the system that is not supportive. And yeah. So a lot of times when people are saying, don't make me feel guilty, I think we have to turn that around and say, well, we're not trying to make you feel guilty. We want you to be frustrated with what the difficulties that are put in place by all of these systemic issues. So maybe talk a little bit about that as well.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're absolutely right. We always talk about turn that frustration into kind of anger for good, right? And so how do we all get really upset around the ways that we're not being supported, the ways that when people don't have those options and choices, and what can we do together to fight against that? And I think there's also, I have to say this, because one of the things that's really common, you know, in breastfeeding dialogues, and often is white women who say guilt and shame, who say people are shaming me, people are pressuring me. And I often tell them, like, I've worked in Detroit, New Orleans, Philadelphia, many places. I have never heard a Black woman say that she was being pressured to breastfeed. I wish. And so I tell people, when a Black woman in Detroit is telling me how she was pressured to breastfeed, then I will be so happy. So please understand that even that pressure, quote unquote, whatever that may look like to you, is a privilege, because breastfeeding has been associated with good mothering historically. It's been a white female dominated perception of breastfeeding. The field has been white female dominated. And so the idea that Black women don't breastfeed is actually more of the common narrative. So when people see a white woman and they know that they think that she should be doing her best and she should, you know, do the thing, then that's a pressure perhaps. But please note that it is rare and frankly uncommon for me to hear Black women being pressured to breastfeed. And I would love to hear that. I would love to.
That's so interesting. That really is an amazing, fascinating piece to think about. So, you know, we talked a little bit about big business, about the pharmaceutical companies that manufacture the artificial baby milks and how they're trying to sell you things and how they undermine breastfeeding through that. Can you say a little bit more about some of their tactics or things that they do to help kind of undermine breastfeeding and make people feel like, you know, they're at war with each other?
Yeah, I mean, I think much of it starts with language. You know, when they say they're just as good, when they feel like they're replicating. I used to get a lot of emails from people saying, can you tell me what's the formula with the breast milk in it, right? Because they would market breast milk components like DHA and RARA and all those things. You know, and when I did the research, the way that they're making it can, you know, one of the processes involves burning rocket fuel, right? And so not exactly natural and not the way it's made in, you know, in breast milk. And so, but people get confused, and a lot of it has been intentional, right? The intentional idea to confuse. And we think about, I talk about this in the book, what happened with the big tobacco companies, right? The smoking gun email, which was said, doubt is our product. And as long as they can make you doubt that breast milk is, you know, can't be compared and can't be replicated, as long as they can make you doubt that, you know, oh, like as long as they make you feel like this formula could be close to it or just as good, they're like, that's what they're really selling. And I think that's an important part of it. So we see in the marketing, we know that for years, and this, you know, is getting better in the US, but the ways that they have directly marketed physicians right now, they have nutrition institutes where they're teaching physicians about nutrition. I say this example in the book, if you went to a nutritionist or a dietitian and they told you they went to, they were trained at that McDonald's Institute, you wouldn't go to them, right? You would think that is not the place where I want you to learn about nutrition and diet. But every day, a doctor, a pediatrician have been educated, quote unquote, at the Nestle or the Similac or the Abbott Labs, quote unquote, Nutrition Institute. And that's perfectly acceptable. The people who are building the competitive product are now responsible for educating you on the on its competition? No. They're not going to do it. They're not going to do it. And so they'll do a little bit, but they're not going to really do it. And so, like, this is the part where you have to understand when we look at the lack of training in medical schools, right? How much I surveyed lots of doctors. I mean, some of them had a half a day of training. Some of them had 2 hours on lactation management. So these are the things, the ways that we know that we talked about the rebates, even in our own country. You know, WIC is making great progress in terms of supporting breastfeeding, but WIC is the largest infant formula purchaser in our country. And the whole system only functions because of infant formula rebates. That's the only way the WIC system, they count on it. And hospitals count on that money. And so when we think about even efforts like Baby Friendly, the issue for hospitals with Baby Friendly is not that they don't support breastfeeding. They can't figure out how to survive without the money they've been getting from the infant formula rebates. It's a financial decision because they've been on the, you know, on the teat of the infant formula companies, to use a bad pun, for so many years. And so these are the commercial aspects behind the scenes. And then we see the aggressive marketing of infant formula. We see the ways that the messaging has been off. And we see how many times they too play into mommy wars with their commercials and things like that. So all of it is just, you know, unacceptable and, you know, a little disgusting.
Yeah, and it's pretty subtle in so many ways. I mean, it used to be that before the WHO code, World Health Organization marketing directive, that people in the Philippines or some other poorer possibly countries might go into villages with dressed as nurses, you know, with formula in hand. And that was a little kind of, you know, that was really obvious what was going on. So I think they've pulled back from a lot of that and gotten even more subtle. And so it's, you know, sometimes it's very insidious and you can't really tell that you're being marketed to. I mean, obviously there's always going to be people who need formula, and that's, you know, it's important that it's there, but the fact that it's a product for profit and, you know, people are trying to maximize their profit, I think leads to all kinds of issues. I mean, yes, I love what you said about them all trying to make it seem like it's more and more like breast milk, but it never can be, because breast milk is a living substance and they're never going to be able to put a living substance in cans and market it, you know, worldwide. So
absolutely. I'm like, well, where's the study that says that infant formula is better than breast milk? It doesn't exist. Mm-mm. It doesn't exist. Yeah. So, you know, people really have to think about that. And to your point, you know, when you're dealing with a profit motive, and remember, I was a business journalist at Fortune, so I really enjoyed this research when I was working on my book, you know, when that means the only way they can increase their market share is to get fewer people to breastfeed or to get more fewer people to breastfeed for longer. So they need to decrease duration or decrease initiation, right? And so they only make money when breastfeeding fails. Like that's their model, you know, that's the fact of it. And so they spend a lot of money figuring out how to make sure that that breastfeeding will fail. And so even when I remember one point in my research, I was reading some analyst report, listening. So this was the former CEO of Mead Johnson, which used to make Infamil, now owned by Reckitt Benckiser. But he was saying in this public analyst call that, you know, breastfeeding had increased, but they saw that more women were getting jobs. And he was hopeful, he was certain, I should say, that the increase in employment levels among women would decrease breastfeeding rates, right? And so he's so aware of the barrier that work causes for breastfeeding. He's counting on that in his projections, that as he sees more women going to work, he's counting that to say, okay, breastfeeding is going to go down, right? Now, he's not going to invest in actually removing some of these barriers, these workplace barriers for breastfeeding, because he's counting on the fact that breastfeeding is going to decrease and diminish when more women are going to work. And so, you know, the fact that they know the trends and they try to leverage them and manipulate them to the advantage of more sales, is part of the part that needs to be addressed. You know, like to your point, formula needs to be there for all the babies who need it. But, you know, the fact that it should be a second option for those who cannot breastfeed versus being the first choice where people don't even are thinking about it. That's where we need to make sure it's a truly level playing field for decision making.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the sexualization that you mentioned is really interesting. I mean, if you look at some of the marketing, it's always usually a mother in her nightgown somewhere, obviously not out in public, you know, so they have these very subtle things like you don't want to ever do this in public. Of course, that makes it very difficult to continue long term. And I even was reading that at one point, formula companies realized that the women who started out breastfeeding, they were going to then wean and then continue using formula long term. So they thought it was in their best interest to do some like encouraging of breastfeeding, where they would have some like, you know, breastfeeding guides that they would send out, and they would say, oh, breast is best, because they knew that those women who started out breastfeeding, not that went right to formula, the ones that went right to formula would often switch over to cow's milk more quickly. And the ones that breastfed at first would use their product longer. So it's really very, very subtle and insidious in so much of what they do.
So true. So true.
Absolutely.
If I keep talking about it, I'll be really upset.
Absolutely. Well, let's move on to something else that I wanted to discuss with you. And, you know, I consider myself a feminist, so the section on feminism in your book was a little bit upsetting to me, a little bit disturbing, but it made a lot of sense, obviously. So can you talk a little bit about the influence of the feminist movement on breastfeeding?
Yeah, and I consider myself a feminist too, or a womanist, whatever we're calling ourselves these days. But, you know, I think that one of the points that I make, the two key points I try to make around this, around the feminist movement, that the ways that they did not value mothering as important work. And so that's something where there was a very important quest, a very important fight to be viewed as equal to men. Very important goal. But in that fight, we neglected to fight for the things that make us uniquely women, which include birth and breastfeeding. And so those things that we uniquely do got lost and devalued in our quest to be viewed as equal to men. And I think that was a strategic misstep that we are dealing with now, right? So now women are being forced into male work patterns, right? Why do we have to go back to work in 10 days when we just gave birth to a child? Well, we want to be equal to men, right? And so there wasn't space for the and, it was an or, and there really needs to be an and for us to get the supports that we also need when we do the things that women uniquely do. And so that for me is really just a call to action for the feminist movement, that to make sure that we don't make that mistake again, right? Because we have many waves of feminism throughout history. And that in this next wave, that we make sure that we include the things that women need, as you know, when they also do their birthing and lactating and all those types of things. I think that's critically important. And then, you know, the other piece for me around feminism is just the ways that women are being shamed for using their bodies to feed their children. It seemed like a feminist agenda, right? And so we think about the ways that women are being kicked out of airports, restaurants, the ways that women are told to put their breast away when you're using your body for its biological purpose, right? Like, these are the things feminists used to get up in arms about, but they haven't said a peep. They never have. And so it's deeply concerning that really breastfeeding is a bodily autonomy issue, our right to feed our babies with our bodies anywhere and anytime that we please, would seem very much a feminist issue, but yet they've been, you know, in a historical context, silent. And that's concerning to me. Because for me, if you're, you know, for something like that, if nothing else, if you can't make some noise for the fact that people are being kicked out of Victoria's Secrets of all places, a place made literally to decorate breasts, then I'm not sure where your feminist agenda lies. That's a problem. That's a problem.
Absolutely. It almost seems like they equate breastfeeding with kind of like being a traditional woman or something like that. And I agree with you because I do think a lot of the feminist movement isn't so much about women being equal to men as it is sort of women becoming kind of what the role, taking on the roles of men. And, you know, that, so it's all about like, you know, getting the high powered job and all those kinds of things rather than having things that fit into our lives as women on an equal basis. So yeah, I think that's
and to do both. It's like, yes, you can go get that corporate job and you can choose mothering. And I think there's a difference between, I think when we look at the early waves of feminism, and yes, for us to think about the distinction of, you know, no one should be forced to be barefoot and pregnant and stuck at home, right? Like no one should be forced into that. But for women who truly choose mothering, there should be support for them. There should be all the things in place. And I think, yes, we don't want women to be stuck at home and be forced to mother. Agree 100%. But what happened when we tried to kind of assert that was that now for those who choose, there's nothing for them. There's no support. And I also say this as a reproductive rights issue. I mean, even look at reproductive rights. It's been around not getting pregnant, important. Ending an unwanted pregnancy, also important. But what about the right to actually have a baby, not die from it, particularly as a Black woman, and feed your baby with what your reproductive, feed your baby with your body with what your reproductive organs produce, right? And so again, we need the full spectrum of the reproductive rights conversation because people are out there marching for you not to get pregnant or end an unwanted pregnancy, but nobody's out there marching in case when you actually decide to use your reproductive organs. And so if we are building a true reproductive rights movement, we must look at what women need on the front end when they don't want to, but also on the back end when they choose to, right? And so if not, we're failing a great percentage of people. I mean, I think some numbers show like over 80% of women become mothers in their lifetime. And so if we're building a women's rights movement, it should look at all the roles that women play in their lives, including that of mother, carer, nurturers, whether you're caring for your older relatives, you know, like this is how we need to do better. And these are the points that I was making in the big letdown, so we can make sure that we don't perpetuate and continue these nuances and misses that have continued to cause harm for people when they do become parents.
Absolutely. And also to recognize the role of other people in supporting you know, women or birthing people's right to use their bodies, to feed their children. So, you know, I think, I don't remember if it was Betty Friedan or somebody said something like, you know, we wanted to get into the workplace, but all we got were two jobs or something like that, you know? And so, you know, the support of other people in the community, in the family, that will support people so that, you know, so, that women, so that they can both, you know, do what is their passion and also be the mother they want to be. So absolutely. Yeah.
And to not be penalized for their productive work, I mean, for their reproductive work, right? Right. And I think that's important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So your book is primarily focused on issues in the U.S. So do you have any examples that you can share of how these issues affect people and parents in other countries?
Well, I think when we look at, you know, certainly the U.S. is one of the more starkest examples in terms of policy failures. You know, we look at the UK, we look at Europe, where they do have paid leave. We do have, you know, a more sustained support for mothers for a year. You know, in this country, you know, you may get 10 days or 14 days through FMLA, but, you know, it's just, the policy failures are most severe in the US because we don't, because of something like paid leave. And then we have to rely on employers to fill in the gaps, which many of them have. But again, it becomes a class-based privilege in terms of those employers who have and those employers who haven't. And people just fuck that to get lucky, right? People always say, I got lucky with my job. You shouldn't have to be lucky to get paid leave. It doesn't make any sense. And so I think that that's where we are a unique example. Also, in terms of postpartum just support, which is another thing where people, like in this country, you give birth, you go home. And in some places, you could not see a doctor for 6 weeks. And in that first, in that black hole, people, a lot of breastfeeding things go wrong, or confusion and things. And you're just there by yourself. In pretty much every other country, as a standard practice of care, somebody is coming to your home after you give birth, a midwife or someone is trained. And it's not a standard practice of care in our country, unless perhaps you're participating in a program, visiting nurse or something. But, you know, these policy gaps, which are which disproportionately continue contribute to breastfeeding disparities and breastfeeding gaps, are very severe in the US. But other things around culture, you know, I've spoken in France, and I spoke to a group of mothers who read my book in Germany. I was in Frankfurt. And, you know, they everybody has a struggle. Sometimes it's more about the body and breastfeeding in public. Sometimes it is about employers and not feeling like they're being supported at work. But when we look at, so there are nuances to this all over the world. But I think when we look at the kind of linchpin in this, the paid leave, so you have time to actually do it, we're pretty much the worst place there is.
Absolutely. And I really agree with that. I think that a lot of it has to do with public health systems around the world, that we have such a failure in the US with our health system. It's so profit-based and employer-based, and it's not, you know, it's not a societal value to value that that families need support, that women need help to take care of their children or to take care of their bodies, that kind of thing. So I really agree with that. I think that's so important. I hear so many times about, you know, health visitors that come to your home in other countries after you have a baby. We don't have anything like that in the US.
No. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is. It really is a societal value that values, I think, profit over, you know, the ability of our families to thrive in our country. So absolutely.
We pay a lot of lip service to family friendly policies, but we really don't have any.
Right. Absolutely. So can you talk a little bit about some of the policy changes and other things that we can do to overcome these challenges, both like as a society or as individuals?
Well, yeah, I mean, the first thing, obviously, I'm going to just say paid leave again. And then I think that, you know, as women, we have to see these issues as universal, you know, and I think now with the pandemic and the ways we're seeing women being forced into all these different roles, the numbers that we see women leaving the workforce because they've been thrust into all of these other quote unquote jobs that they now have to play as well. And so I'm hoping that a silver lining out of this pandemic would be that we can come together and, you know, see that we need affordable childcare. Like we need, you know, to be valued for our unpaid labor, you know, and of which breastfeeding is one of them, right? It's work, and people will pay for it. So there's value there in terms of the milk. And so how do we now use this as a pivot point and a turning point for us to push for these policies, hopefully something better with this administration. But I think this is a moment for us to come together, particularly with the pandemic and all the learnings, the things that we already knew, but have been brought to light and brought into media mainstream attention, that we can now use that as our way forward for us to push for something better. So I think that's really important. And then that we also continue to make sure that our healthcare system is serving us. You know, we've been pushing and make sure it's serving everyone. You know, we just had a new law that's going to extend that postpartum coverage period for those who are on Medicaid. So, you know, so many simple things that can do so much to transform our own maternal infant health landscape for all of us that really just need the will, just need the political will. And how can we, as a powerful group and always like to shout out Moms Rising and organizations like that that are looking to harness the power that we know we have and to turn that into policy action. And so would certainly encourage all of your listeners to see how they can support Moms Rising, sign petitions, call, you know, like we're all sitting, we're all home right now. I make a lot of calls for all sorts of places, just, you know, leaving comments for senators and representatives, et cetera. But we can all do our part to use our collective voices for change.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we, and our, you know, our health system, you know, needs tremendous support and revision. Because so much of the time people can't afford certain, you know, they can't afford lactation care, they can't afford, you know, postpartum care, because their insurance doesn't cover it. And so, mm-hmm. you know, that's another place where I think there's a lot of policy reform needed. So absolutely. Yeah, I definitely, you know, we hear in the United States about this new infrastructure bill and people saying, well, it's not really infrastructure, it's not roads and bridges. Well, you know, if you're going to go to work, you know, it's fine if you have a road to drive to and a bridge to drive over. But if you don't have childcare, you're not going to be able to participate in the workplace. So it is infrastructure. So it absolutely.
Yeah. And I appreciate this conversation that we're having about what is infrastructure, like what are the foundational elements that we as a society need to function? And sorry, people, childcare is one of them, you know? And so I really, you know, am impressed and really want to commend, you know, this administration, whoever helped them reframe that conversation. I think it's an important reframing that people need to consider. Like, you're right. I can't use that bridge or road if I don't have affordable childcare that allows me to even get to work. So yeah, these things are connected.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm going to pivot a little bit first to talk a little bit about your podcast, Birthright, which focuses on stories of Black women reclaiming joy and power in their birth. Could you tell us a little bit about how historical trauma and racism has contributed to such a high rate of maternal complications and mortality in the African-American community?
Yeah, I mean, thank you for asking that question. So, I mean, we look at historically, you know, the medical system, particularly if we look at the history of obstetrics and gynecology, right? Dr. Marion Sims, who was known as the quote unquote father of gynecology, really based his whole foundational science on using enslaved Black women's bodies, obviously without the permission, but without anesthesia to practice on. And so here is a person who literally built his reputation and built the foundations of the OBGYN scientific field by using Black women's bodies. And so when we look at this culture, this history of, again, who's being valued in this system, who's been demeaned by this system, and that continues. And so when we look at the Black maternal mortality rates, I live in New York City, which is one of my favorite places, but the Black maternal mortality rate is 12 times that of white women, right, in New York City. Right. And so that's something that I think we all can agree is shameful. And when we look at the research, there was plenty of times when they were trying to problematize Black women. Oh, we don't go to prenatal care. We have high blood pressure, all these things. But all the studies have taken that out. Our healthcare structure, it's like, no, we have to talk about racism. We have to talk about racism. When we look at someone like Serena Williams, what happened with her childbirth experience, how she nearly died, we know that this is not about low-income women, right? We have a celebrity and someone who's actually married to a white billionaire and still was ignored. So this is not about Black women. It is about the people who see Black skin and, you know, switch to a different level of care. This has been very well documented as well, the ways that bias shows up. One landmark study showed physicians given different treatment options for hypothetical Black patients than they did for hypothetical white patients with the same symptoms, right? So we've seen this repeatedly, American Journal, you know, all the places. And so unfortunately for Black women, it's, you know, disastrous results. But as we tell these important statistics, my concern was that there was this narrative that was always doom and gloom, that was always focusing on that. And people were becoming afraid. And I was getting those emails too, you know, from husbands and fathers who are like, I'm afraid for my wife, for my girlfriend, for my child's mother. What can we do? You know, we get emails from people who are like, do I need to prepare my will before I give birth? I mean, just sad, sad things. And I'm like, this fear is concerning. And so I wanted to remind people that there's actually joy in Black birth as well. And we can learn from that, right? Like when people die, they do a whole review board, but what can we learn from people who have survived, who have had a great experience that could also be a lesson to the field? So yeah. Birthright is really about, you know, highlighting positive birth stories as lessons, but also as inspiration to remind Black people that it is possible. And so we highlight the stories of Black women and birthing people. We also do healing circles. We just did one we call the Restoration episode, where we take those who have had birth trauma, we sit them with a therapist and a healer, and we try to help them heal, because there's a lot of trauma from birth in the Black community. And if we don't start to heal it, it's going to just keep being repeated, right? And so it's really, I'm really proud of the podcast. It's funded by the California Healthcare Foundation. So I'm very grateful for their support. But I think it's important, you know, again, as a journalist, that we think about the narrative, and we constantly think about how we can shift the narrative, make sure it's always balanced, and it's not just all negativity.
Absolutely. I love the one where you had she was an experienced mother. She had several children already, but she was in the hospital because she was in early labor and she was, you know, going to have a premature baby, but she surrounded herself with her tribe, her group, her, you know, all of these people to support her. And it was so beautiful how she just took charge of all that and really was able to reclaim joy, even in a very stressful situation.
Exactly.
So I love that. That was just amazing. And all of them are really amazing. So now, is this primarily an American phenomenon, or do you find this in other countries, this historical trauma and racism around birth in other societies?
Well, you know, we have it here in the most severe form, but as you may know, it's actually also happening in the UK. They recently had their Embrace report that showed that Black women in the UK are 5 times more likely to die during and after childbirth. So, you know, we're seeing the UK numbers start to mirror the US numbers. And so we really, again, have to start to understand the impact of racism, the ways people are treated differently within the system, and how we can work on that. You know, what the work I do with Earth is all about, how do we create more transparency and accountability around that system, so that we can, one, see for ourselves where others say they've gotten good reviews and ratings. And then on the back end, how do we share that with doctors and hospitals so that they can have new data to better inform what they're trying to do?
Yeah, and I'm sure there's a lot of, you know, colonialism, you know, imperialism around the world that has really affected how, you know, Black women give birth in other places that we haven't even researched at this point. So
Exactly. Yeah.
So what are Black birthing people doing to reclaim their birthright? Can you give us some examples? I mentioned one of your podcasts, but I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah. So, wow, so many different things. I mean, many of them are thinking about out of hospital options, midwifery care, childbirth centers, right? Can you give birth in a hospital with a midwife? Really trying to think about going back because the solutions have always been in our community. The granny midwives, those who were birthing babies were Black women from time. And again, that white male dominated medical system really demonized and criminalized midwives and made them obsolete and snuffed them out. And so now, many Black birthing people are looking for those models, those community-centered models. Obviously, doulas are something that we highly advocate for as a way to educate yourself. And I always say that because people think the doula is there to, you know, fight for you in the hospital. I'm like, the doula is there to educate you before you get to the hospital so that you're in a better position to ask questions for yourself, right? I've had 2 C-sections that I still can't fully explain because I didn't know what to say. I didn't know my body well enough to ask the question or to say, wait a minute, you know, but if this is happening, then that just means, you know, I just didn't know. And the ways that I see birthing people who have doulas who are educated about their bodies, so they know the process. You can't just tell them anything and they'll go along with it. They know the follow-up and what if we do nothing? And, you know, is this? I mean, it's the education. because we've all been so taken away from our knowledge of our bodies and the childbirth process. It's just that for Black people, it has become more disastrous because that just means someone else has more control over you. Plus, when we get into stereotypes, you know, their treatment of you is worse. But we've all been disconnected from that knowledge of how our bodies work, how our breasts work, right? And so we really are in a reclamation work across the board. I'm also the creator and co-founder of Black Breastfeeding Week. And so for me, these two go hand in hand, that we're also reclaiming on the breastfeeding side, the ways that we're going back into those community-centered models on the birthing side. Another thing that we see a lot in the podcast, people really seeking out Black OBGYNs who they build a relationship with. They feel safer with some of them. And so we, you know, that's been something that's comes up a lot on the podcast. And so, but really people are, you know, learning for themselves. And that I think is the most important part.
Absolutely. That education is key. I mean, it shouldn't be necessary that, you know, people should be, you know, educated in the hospital, whatever it is. People shouldn't have to speak up for themselves, but it's important, you know how to speak up for yourself in these kind of situations. So
exactly.
Absolutely. So tell us a little bit more about your new app Earth, because I think this is in some ways how people can find these providers and these support people to help with them have the birth that they want.
Yeah. So Earth is a Yelp-like review and rating app for Black and brown women and birthing people to find and leave reviews of OBGYNs, birthing hospitals, and pediatric providers up to baby's first birthday. And so we really want to, on the front end, give people a tool to see how people like them. We want to leverage consumer forces, and we want to let the medical system know that we are sharing publicly where we are receiving good care and where we are not. And we want those who are doing well to be celebrated and known in our community. And those who are not doing well need to be highlighted so they can be improved, so they can be marked for improvement. And then on the back end, we turn those qualitative experiences into quantitative data. So now we have detailed, we can say, listen, we have 1,000 reviews and 80% of people are saying their pain levels are being dismissed. We get a lot of details about, we have a whole, one of the app screens kind of walks you through some common negative behaviors. We just did our first data release was just like a mini report. And of the top 5 negative behaviors, number 1 was requests for help were ignored or refused, right? That's the most reported negative experience in the app. Requests for help were ignored or refused. Number 2, pain levels dismissed. And number 3 was rude comments. And so we see these patterns and we want to show this to hospitals so that they don't dismiss it, right? Because many times, you know, if it happens to one person, they'll try to explain it away. But when we put all of our experiences together and now we have these numbers, now we have power to say this is not a one-off and we expect you to do better. And so our goal is to ultimately use Earth as a tool to educate hospitals and providers so they can get better. And then my vision is that Earth becomes this good housekeeping seal of approval for Black and brown women and birthing people, so that providers will want to earn an Earth approved rating, an Earth approval stamp, as it were, that they could display in their hospital and their doctor's office, and that hospitals would earn this accreditation, right? And so now it becomes something that is desired and actually required, particularly if you're working in Black and brown neighborhoods.
Absolutely. So
that's cool. Yeah.
And I do want to mention once again that it is spelled IRTH. So it is like the word birth without the B for bias. It's not Earth like the planet. So if you're looking for it, it should be available in either the Apple Play or Google Play locations. So please find and download, and absolutely it's a fabulous new resource for Black women. So I wanted to go back a little bit to breastfeeding, because, you know, African-American women have, as you know, of course, have also experienced historical trauma around breastfeeding. Can you say a little bit about how that happened and ways that they can heal from this kind of trauma?
Yes. Well, you know, when we go back to, again, the history of Black people in this country, particularly when Black women were enslaved, they were often stopped from nursing their own children, forced to breastfeed the children of their oppressors, right? And so the slave owner knew the value of the milk, but also because breastfeeding reduces fertility, many times they were forced to wean early so that they could breed more children, which had economic value to the slave owner, right? And so this was a major disruption in the motherhood experience. And you know, to feed your baby is your first job as a mother, and to be forced to do that for others. If you look at some of the slave narratives, you know, their own baby suffered because they were being forced. And so this was a disruption that created a continued generational trauma around breastfeeding. Later, when Black women were free but had very few work options, wet nursing was one of the few things that they could do to earn money. And so this kind of created a legacy of generational trauma. Breastfeeding is something we did for other people, we didn't do for ourselves, something that has a negative connotation that reminds us of a time we like to forget. And so these are all the things that have contributed to these breastfeeding disparities, which have existed for over 40 years. And so through Black Breastfeeding Week, which happens every year, August 25th to 31st, we try to celebrate breastfeeding and we reclaim that tradition. We're very community centered. We talk about, you know, the ways that we are rebuilding our communities to center breastfeeding. We talk about breastfeeding as social justice because it was something that was taken away from us and that we had a negative experience around because of racism and because of enslavement. So we really try to center these themes in a very, very empowering way. We don't talk about disparities and what we're not doing. It is very positive, and we try to center the ways that we can reclaim this tradition for our own children and for our own community.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just fabulous. I love Black Breastfeeding Week every year. It's always got so many inspiring aspects to it. So thank you so much, Kimberly. This has been just absolutely fabulous. Is there anything else that you wanted to share that we haven't covered in this interview?
No, I think we've covered everything. You know, thank you for the great work that we're doing, that you're doing. Real excited for people to learn more about Earth and, you know, visit earthapp.com, download, share with your friends. Visit birthrightpodcast.com and subscribe. We also have video extras that we do a lot on the Birthright Podcast YouTube page. So you can see great interviews that I've done with some of the mamas outside of the podcast. And so, you know, it's a great time and I'm excited to share about these opportunities and the ways that we are pushing forward for equity.
Absolutely. And definitely read The Big Letdown by Kimberly Seals Allers. It's just fabulous. Required reading in my book. So thank you so much, Kimberly. This has been fantastic. I really appreciate your taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.